From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. The coronavirus pandemic has upended just about everything, including election year campaigning. Door knocking, jam-packed rallies, shaking thousands of hands and posing for tens of thousands of selfies, all off the table for the foreseeable future. While the pandemic throws traditional campaigning into a brand new tumult, perhaps it's also focusing voters' minds on exactly what kind of leadership they want in their local state houses and in the White House. So this hour on Point, we'll explore American politics in the midst of the pandemic. And we'll start with Anthony Brooks. He's On Point's 2020 political correspondent and WBUR senior political reporter, and he joins us from Dublin, New Hampshire today. Hello there, Anthony.
Hey, Meghna.
How you doing?
I'm doing very well. How about you?
We're doing as well as one can be expected in the midst of an unprecedented.
I think that's the best way to put it.
Global
as well as can be expected.
News of it, indeed.
Absolutely.
All right. So, you know, life has changed for everybody, especially these campaigns, which it feels like it was a lifetime ago, but it actually wasn't that long ago when it was all we were talking about. So, how much has changed for the various political campaigns that are trying to find their way through this?
Yeah, it's really something. I mean, I remember the last sort of traditional political rally that I was at. It was an Elizabeth Warren event out in Detroit. I think I talked to you shortly after that. It was maybe, 3 weeks ago or something like that. It feels like a lifetime ago. So how have these campaigns changed? No more rallies, no more kissing babies, no more fist bumps, no more big events. And So, talking now about the presidential campaigns, they've had to sort of transition to an online-only existence. And that hasn't been necessarily straightforward or easy for them, especially for Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders.
So talk a little bit about that, about Biden first.
Well, I mean, Biden has probably faced the steepest learning curve. And I say that because Sanders probably has a bit of an advantage in the sense that his grassroots campaign existed in a big way online. It was sort of a bigger part of his campaign. It was more evolved. So we've seen Joe Biden kind of struggle with online campaigning in the early days. I'm talking about technical glitches, awkward silences, technical glitches. You see the former vice president sort of talking and wandering out of the camera shot, not realizing that he has to sort of stay on camera there, that sort of thing. You know, and there have been a lot of stories as well with the headline or the sort of sub-headline, "Where's Joe? Where's Joe Biden?" I mean, this is a real challenge for him to stay visible and to stay present, especially when we presume he's going to be the Democratic candidate who's running against a president who has the advantage of the White House bully pulpit and those daily briefings. He's very present.
Well, so Anthony, we'll talk about both the president and Bernie Sanders in a second here, but I want to lean on the multiple presidential election cycles that you have covered and the importance of even in a national race, that face-to-face contact between a campaign and potential voters, because at the rallies that I've been to, you see the candidate responding to like what messages are landing, what the energy is in the room, and sort of the idea that there's this circle of feedback between voters
Absolutely.
And a campaign, and they're not getting that now. Is that
right.
Significant?
I think it's hugely significant. I mean, those big campaign rallies do two things. I mean, of course, they connect with voters in real time on the ground, but they also create enormous amounts of free media. And by the way, this is a problem for President Trump, too, because he gets a lot of mileage from pumping up his local supporters with those big, massive rallies. So he's going to miss those as well. I mean, he's missing those as well. He has sort of an advantage, though, because he's got a pretty highly evolved online presence, and it's not only his steady use of Twitter, but his campaign has been pumping out all kinds of materials to supporters for a long, long time online. And I was thinking about this as well. His daily briefings, around which there's some controversy, and some folks are talking about the media shouldn't be covering them on a daily basis because they often involve a lot of information that can't be verified or doesn't conform with the facts. But it's interesting how there are elements of those daily briefings that are similar to his large campaign rallies. And I'm thinking most pointedly of the way he bashes the media and uses those briefings frequently to call out the media and accuse them of being purveyors of fake news and so on and so forth. And that's a theme that he often, you know, resorts to in his big rallies. So in a way, he's keeping that thread of his campaign, of his perpetual campaign alive.
Mm. Well, let's hear a little bit, going back to Joe Biden here for a moment, and hear a campaign ad that the Biden campaign has put out in this time of a global pandemic. Here's the Biden campaign ad explaining what the former vice president would do if he were to be president right now, obviously making some pretty strong comparisons between himself and President Trump.
Why are we waiting? We know they're needed, and so I would be moving rapidly.
Something's going on, and you ought to look into it as reporters.
Look at what's happening here. You have nurses showing up wearing garbage bags as over their bodies as protection.
Where are the masks going? Are they going out the back door?
We need to get them the help they need right away.
Is something going on? Well, it's not, I don't think it's hoarding. I think it's maybe worse than hoarding.
That's an ad from the Biden presidential campaign. So, Anthony, hang on here for just a second, because I want to bring now into the conversation Alexi McCammon, joining us from Washington. Alexi is a political reporter at Axios, focusing on the 2020 presidential election. Alexi, welcome to On Point.
Hey, Meghna. Thank you for having me.
I'm doing. First of all, how are you doing, Alexi? I'm checking in with everybody.
You know, hopefully you've had your coffee this morning. I feel like we're all adjusting to this weird new reality that we're in. You know, it's really kind of unsettling, but the one heartening thing is seeing how much technology has actually brought us closer. When I feel like prior to the coronavirus, technology made us feel a little more distant and impersonal.
Okay. Well, I'm always constantly telling my staff every day, I'm looking for those silver linings. So bring them to the table anytime you can.
Yes, yes.
So you heard what Anthony was saying about how profoundly campaigning has changed. So reflect on that with us. I mean, as you've talked about, like Joe Biden has a TV studio in his living room now?
Yeah, well, I think it's a recreation room. In
okay, a rec room. All
right. But yeah, it's all the same, right? Like, that is a bizarre reality that is part of the situation we're in right now, especially folks who are running for president, is that you have to meet voters where they are. And voters are now not coming out to see you. You have to find them. And they are all glued to their TVs because we're all stuck at home, or the majority of us are stuck at home, and therefore watching more TV. So Joe Biden is completely overhauling his campaign in real time. And he's sort of standing up a shadow presidency of sorts amid this national emergency that has really eclipsed all other news, as you both know very well.
Well, and so how can campaigns tell if this overhaul is effective, if it's if it's reaching voters? Because first and foremost, just to state the obvious, there's a lot else going on in voters' lives right now that it seems like it's doubly or triply hard to get those messages that are coming at them from at a distance to penetrate.
Yeah, I think that's right, Meghna. And we all know that there is little to no appetite right now for political coverage because of this global pandemic. And, you know, I know when I talk to Biden campaign aides and folks on Biden's team, they point to things like how much they've raised in March, which I think they raised like $35 million in the first 2 weeks. But of course, that was before coronavirus really kind of took off. They're holding these tele-fundraisers and, you know, they talk about how there's 117 people who dial into these things. So they use those metrics and those data points to talk about how they're breaking through in a tangible way that helps the campaign. But I think you're right. When I talked to swing voters in Edina, Minnesota recently for these focus groups that we do for Axios with Obama-Trump voters, none of them had heard a single thing that Joe Biden has said about coronavirus. Now, it was a focus group, so there were only eight folks. That's not statistically significant like a poll. But I would imagine they're not the only eight people in the country who would say they haven't heard Joe Biden say anything about coronavirus. And that's because if you're not seeking out these live streams, you're going to miss these things. Or if you're not watching MSNBC or CNN, you know, when they're doing these interviews during the day, you're going to miss the things that they're saying. So you really have to opt in to the presidential election now, whereas before, I feel like Americans had to opt out.
Interesting. If you're as Anthony was saying earlier, President Trump, by virtue of being the president, I'm sure those voters that you talked to had heard much of what he had to say.
Yes, That's right. And that, and you were talking about this earlier, Meghna, and I think it's a really fascinating dynamic that we're seeing. You know, we know that President Trump is sort of this supernova figure who can transcend any type of noise or clutter within the news cycle. He dictates the news cycle oftentimes. Now he has things like Fox News town halls to talk about coronavirus and other things, which are, you know, not held to the same equal time standards as other paid media might be or media appearances might be. And so in, on top of the daily briefings that he's doing, he's getting these other opportunities to really speak directly to Americans every single day. Whereas before, we couldn't even get a press briefing from the White House press secretary for months. And now Americans are seeing the president himself at the podium every single day. I think that's something that Democrats are keenly aware of, and they're trying to figure out how to flood the airwaves. We're seeing outside Democratic groups, you know, launch plans to do that now. But they are really competing with President Trump for attention in a way that they just haven't had to before. Mm.
Anthony, go ahead and jump in here.
Meghna, it seems to be paying off for the president, too. I mean, I was looking at this latest survey from Gallup. It showed that Mr. Trump's approval rating is now at 49%. That's equal to the best of his presidency so far. So even though he's created a lot of controversy around things that he said around the coronavirus and big questions about whether his administration took it seriously enough early enough, I think because he's so visible, he's kind of grabbed a whole lot of people and sort of forced them to pay attention to him, people who might not have been paying attention to him yet. And that seems, at least so far, I mean, this is early times, to have accrued to his advantage in the kind of ways that Alexei's describing. It's really dramatic.
Well, I mean, and in all fairness, Anthony, no matter who might be the president now, I mean, wouldn't that kind of be a natural effect? Because, you know, we look to who's in the White House for leadership at times like this.
No question. I mean, when presidents historically are faced with crises, often their approval ratings go up. It's a different story when we move closer to an election day, whether they're dealing with, say, a war versus a depression. And we can talk about that later in the show. But no question, there is this initial rallying around the president in times of crises. And we're definitely in one of those right now.
Well, Anthony Brooks and Alexei McCammon, hang on here for just a second. We are talking about campaign politics and the pandemic. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about campaigns, politics, and the pandemic. And we want to know what you think. Have you paid attention at all to campaigns and the election once this global pandemic really set in your lives? And when November does roll around and you have a chance to vote, what kind of leadership will you be voting for that you need in the midst of a global pandemic? I'm joined today by Anthony Brooks. He's On Point's 2020 political correspondent and a senior political reporter for WBUR. And Alexei McCammon also joins us. She's a political reporter at Axios, focusing on the presidential election. And let's quickly go to a call. Let's go to Jeffrey, who's calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Jeffrey, you're on the air.
I mean, it's a pleasure to be here. Jeff Sanchez, I'm with Grassley Partners. We're a government public relations firm, and I was a former Ways and Means chair in the House of Representatives here. And I saw elections change last time around. This time around, we're finding ourselves calling people in a very, very different way than how we did in the past. Now it's calling people and trying to figure out how can we help you, and providing those volunteers that we have with the toolkit so that they're able to talk to people in a way so that they don't feel like they're being campaigned at. And it's a new way of doing things, because at the end of the day, when you're calling somebody, you got to be really careful because you don't know the conditions that you're finding somebody when they do pick up the phone.
Jeff, can you just jump in here? Jeff, can I just jump in here for a second? Because I want to, if you allow me for a moment, just to put the political questions aside, there's a couple of things that we should acknowledge. I mean, you said you thank you for your full disclosure. You work for Rasky Partners, which we should know is a political communications firm. And again, putting the politics aside for just a second, Larry Rasky, the head of Rasky Partners, just died last week from COVID-19. Yeah. I just wanted to acknowledge that and say,
loss for us.
We're sorry for your loss. Again, putting the politics aside, I want to focus on the human moment for a second. How has that had an impact on you and your colleagues?
It's had a dramatic impact on us in terms of how do we talk to people? You know, how do we talk about these things within our company, within our community, and in the work that we do? Because we know that people are confronting the greatest challenge of our lifetimes with this coronavirus. Mm. You know, people don't know what's happening in their own homes.
Yeah.
So we have to be really, really sensitive to it. And at the same time, we also know that there are a lot of people that are super isolated in their own homes. So we really have to bring the compassion into this as well and not pander or peddle politics to people right now.
Right.
And I think that we're seeing that on the ground with the number of initiatives that some of the campaigns are working on. On the Batty campaign, I see it, and on some of the local campaigns, I see it as well. The next couple of weeks are going to be even more challenging, especially here in Massachusetts, where the governor has kept the stay-at-home order till May 4th and saying that we're potentially going to peak between April 7th and the 14th. And at the same time, you have the initiatives that you have to have some finality to, meaning signatures for political representatives to get onto the ballot for the primaries for local elections.
Yeah.
And at the same time, ballot question petition initiatives that require a significant number of signatures to be carried as well that you have to do face-by-face and you can't do by electronic signature.
Well, so Jeff, again, in the interest of full disclosure, Rasky Partners is working for the Biden campaign, right? And in fact, Larry Rasky, before he died, he ran a super PAC supporting Joe Biden. So we want to be clear and transparent about that.
Larry Rasky was a great friend of Joe Biden, and he headed up the super PAC. But that super PAC operates separate from the campaign.
Yeah.
Dramatically separately from the campaign.
But so when your communications firms though is still calling, you have to say, you're telling voters who pick up the phone, you're calling on behalf of a campaign though. You're asking a different set of questions, but you're still calling on behalf of a campaign. Have voters been wanting to have those conversations with campaign operatives about politics right now? That's what I'm wondering.
It's a mixed bag. You do get people that are picking up the phone and are picking up the phone. And again, but the change in the question, you know, before, you know, when I was making questions, when I was calling for my own campaign, it was, hi, this is, you know, Sanchez from, you know, running for state rep. I'd like to count on your vote and your support. This is what I've done. You're not getting that now.
Mm.
Right now, it's more, let's check in with our neighbors. Let's see how you're doing. And in a lot of cases, you're not getting the pitch. It's just the acknowledgement that a phone call is being made. And at the same time, through social media, you know, you hit a lot of other folks as well that are engaged.
Yeah.
Either through Twitter, through Instagram, through emails. I mean, the Biden campaign is daily puts out two or three posts to all the volunteers letting know how sensitive we have to be at this time, because it's critical. We have to be sensitive to people because there are so many people that are in a great time of need and during this pandemic.
Yeah. Well, Jeff, thank you. Thank you so much for your call. Anthony, do you want to respond to some of the things that Jeff said?
I really appreciated everything Jeff said, and it sort of reminded me of, you know, just we can shift to sort of the way the local races and some of the down ballot races are conducting their campaigns. And, you know, I've focused a lot prior to the pandemic hitting Massachusetts and the whole world on the Kennedy-Markey race. So this is the incumbent, Senator Ed Markey, is being challenged by Congressman Joe Kennedy. And it's been interesting to watch how this race has sort of taken shape, because similar to the presidential race, obviously no more campaign rallies, no more greeting voters face to face. So what have they done? Well, they've sort of unofficially suspended their campaigns, but the need remains for them to stay visible. And in the way that Mr. Raskey was talking about, you know, Markey has been very sort of visible as a senator, doing a senator's work down in Washington. And clearly, you know, that's the way he's running his campaign right now, to respond to people's needs. And as a challenger, Joe Kennedy has been doing much the same thing. He's been doing teletown meetings every night, keeping constituents informed about what the pandemic, how Washington is responding to the pandemic. Sometimes he brings economic experts on. Sometimes he brings doctors on these teletown halls. Sometimes he brings cooks on and sort of talks about what to cook at home and recipes. So it's sort of an interesting way, but it's the shift is not from, you know, I'm running for office and here's why I'm better than my opponent. It's like, we have this pandemic going on. There are a lot of needs out there. I'm here to talk about them. So it is the kind of shift that Mr. Raskey described really well right there.
Anthony, I wonder, could the impact be even larger on the down ballot, the local races? Because, you know, we've seen time and again how knocking on doors, having, you know, neighbors canvass neighbors to get out the vote, et cetera, for these local races are really the things that can turn a campaign, can turn a campaign around. And that is completely gone now.
Absolutely. I mean, looking when I was looking at this Kennedy-Markey race, you know, I talked to a terrific expert, Peter Ubertasio, over at Stonehill College outside of Massachusetts, a political scientist. And he said to me, you know, we know that the single most effective way to win over new supporters is to send a volunteer to knock on a door and then follow up with a phone call or knock. That option is now gone. So the online world of campaigning, I think, is really good at sort of reaching folks who are already tuned into the campaign. It remains to be seen how and if it can really engage new voters. And it also remains to be seen what it's going to do to voter turnout. I mean, sort of sticking with this Kennedy-Markey race, there's a primary coming up in September. Primaries don't typically have huge voter turnout. So the question really is, how is this pandemic going to suppress voter turnout in the weeks and months ahead? And that's a really important question about how well our democracy functions.
Mm. Well, of course, turning out new voters, engaging new voters, is something that Bernie Sanders has been talking about, and, you know, in his campaign for many, many months now, even on the national level. Alexei, I'm going to turn to you here to talk about Sanders for a second, but I just want to play a bit of tape of Senator Sanders. He's still in the race, of course. And this week he joined NBC Late Night host Seth Meyers. And Meyers asked Sanders about his chances, and here's what Senator Sanders said.
Well, we're about 300 delegates behind. Biden has 1,200. We have 900. There is a path. It is admittedly a narrow path. But I would tell you, Seth, that there are a lot of people who are supporting me. We have a strong grassroots movement who believe that we have got to stay in order to continue the fight.
That's Senator Bernie Sanders on NBC's Late Night with Seth Meyers. Alexei McCammon, what is the state of the Sanders campaign right now?
You know, that's the million-dollar question that everyone is asking, and his answer to Seth was a diplomatic one, of course. But I think the reality is that Bernie Sanders is no longer running a presidential campaign. He's increasingly running a coronavirus-focused campaign. And you see that in the ways that he's asked questions about coronavirus and what's happening on the Hill when he's doing TV interviews. He's not asked about his presidential campaign. You see that in the way that he's no longer soliciting donations for his presidential campaign. He's asking voters to donate to places like Meals on Wheels, these organizations that are helping folks who are affected by the coronavirus. You see that also in the way that he's no longer running digital ads on Facebook. His campaign made them inactive a couple of weeks ago in order to conserve resources. And that's because they know that they're facing a tough path forward. They admit that it's a narrow path forward and that they don't really see how the math could work out. Mm. But what remains true is that no one has changed the conversation for the Democratic Party or the politics and policies of the Democratic Party like Bernie Sanders yes. has. I mean, you see that in exit polling. The number of voters who support Medicare for All and single-payer health care has really skyrocketed relative to where it was in 2014, 2015, when Bernie was just sort of starting to lay the groundwork for these once fringe policies to become more mainstream.
So, Alexei, I think this is a really important point, and I want to explore it a little bit more with you because even before the pandemic, Sanders was changing the conversation within the Democratic Party. Now, in the midst of the pandemic, you know, we hear and see people looking to the federal government for the kinds of assistance that Sanders has been talking about. So it's, in fact, sharpened people's attention around the role that they might want government to play, at least in times like this. So is Sanders staying in the race? Is it strengthening the conversation around those policies, or would he be doing a better service to those policies themselves if he dropped out of the race and focused on supporting Biden while saying, and these policies need to become, you know, rock solid at the center of the Democratic nominee.
You know, I think that his team would argue that while he is running for president, he is squarely focused on solutions for the coronavirus pandemic. And I don't think that him staying in the race is changing the conversation around Medicare for All or even some of these other policies at all. He's not talking about them from a position of a presidential candidate. He's talking about them from the Senate floor. He's talking about them from the hallways of the Capitol during these interviews as a senator in the United States Senate. He's not talking about them as a presidential candidate. So yes, I think that getting out of the race might help him, you know, have a more cohesive message and identity. But the reality is that he's no longer running a presidential campaign. So he's squarely focused on his duties as a United States senator. And I think that's a really fascinating thing when you look at how the two candidates, Biden and Sanders, are operating day to day and the way that they talk about the coronavirus. Joe Biden talks about it in terms of what he would do as president. Bernie Sanders talks about what it means for the American people on an economic level, on a healthcare level, and what we need to do in terms of legislation, which is something he can do as a senator. He doesn't have to be president to do that.
Well, Anthony, what does that mean, though, for Sanders' supporters, for his voters?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, listening to Alexia, I sort of wanted to chime in on this question about to what extent Sanders is sort of having an effect on you know, able to influence, essentially, the debate around issues. And I think that's one of the reasons he's staying in. That's one of the reasons why he says to Seth Meyers, well, we still have a path to the nomination. Mathematically, he does. But in fact, he really, really doesn't. But because a lot of these primaries have been put off until June, he can still claim that he's in the race and exert pressure on some of these issues that he really cares about, like, you know, economic support for working Americans, health care is a human right, $15 minimum wage. And we have seen Joe Biden come around at least on one or two of these issues. He's shifted his stance on free college and free college plan, very much in response to Bernie Sanders. So I think Sanders does see a possibility that he can, by staying in this race, he can affect the issues that are being debated in the presidential campaign moving forward. Mm. And we're seeing that bearing some results.
Well, let's get a quick call here before we have to take another break. Chuck is calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Chuck, you're on the air.
Hi, I've been a longtime Bernie Sanders supporter, but I just from my perspective right now, you know, I'm not really thinking about the election. And when I do, the people that I think of are actually the people not running in the race. The person I'm the most impressed with right now is Andrew Cuomo, based on how he has had exemplary leadership skills throughout this crisis. And while Bernie Sanders is on the Hill doing his job and Biden is at home getting out his message, I think the American public is most impressed with the people like Andrew Cuomo who are leading right now.
Mm. Chuck, thank you so much for that call. Alexei, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, thank you for that call. And I think that we are seeing several people, Joe Biden included, give their praise to someone like Governor Andrew Cuomo, because to your point, Americans are looking for a leader with a steady hand who can offer compassion and guidance in a time where all of us are feeling a little, uneasy about the uncertainty that comes with the coronavirus. And I think that's exactly right. And I think that when Americans are thinking about what's going on in the world right now, to your point, again, they're not thinking about the election. They're thinking about their healthcare, their personal health, and their personal financial situation. All of those things are at stake right now.
Well, and then go ahead, Anthony.
Yeah, I mean, it's just the caller. It was such a great call because, I mean, I think one of the things that has come out of this crisis is the important role that governors play. And we talked a moment ago about a Harris poll showing that Trump has like a 49% approval rating right now. Well, some of the surveys show that governors have like a 70% approval rating. And I think there really is a sense in a lot of states, and I think Andrew Cuomo has really given voice to this, that in the absence of consistent, steady leadership from Washington, it has really fallen on the governors to emerge and take on this role of leadership in this unprecedented crisis that we're facing. And I think that's being played out all across the country.
Mm. Well, but also just to circle back to a point you made earlier, Anthony, for people who support President Trump, they're seeing him be president every day as well in those briefings, if it's not explicit campaigning. So that's meaningful, too. We'll talk more about that when we come back. So Anthony and Lexi, stand by. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And tomorrow, it will be yet another Friday, folks, which means it will be time for the On Point Weekly News Roundtable. And guest host Jane Clayson will be here to walk us through all the political and massive economic and cultural changes we're experiencing due to the coronavirus pandemic. So we're going to want to hear from you. What's been your experience dealing with the coronavirus pandemic this week? What about those massive unemployment numbers? What are you hearing from your local leaders, from hospitals, businesses? Leave us a voicemail with your thoughts or questions at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683 for tomorrow's weekly roundtable. Today, we are talking about campaigns, politics, and the pandemic, and Anthony Brooks and Alexi McCammon are with us. Joining us now is Nicholas Riccardi. He's with us from Denver, Colorado. He's a political reporter for the Associated Press covering the western regions of the country. And Nick, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks for having me.
First of all, how are you doing out there in Denver?
As well as can be expected for somebody who is fortunate enough not to have this nasty disease.
Okay, good. We're just, like I said, we're checking in with everyone who's good enough to give us their time for the show. We wanted to talk to you for a couple of minutes, Nick, in order to focus on Senate races in some key states in the western part of the United States, Montana, Colorado, Arizona, for example. So how is this pandemic affecting those races?
Much like the presidential race, the campaigns have really become an afterthought now. The incumbent senators aren't really campaigning. Martha McSally, the Arizona Republican, in fact, announced she was suspending her campaign, taking a break from campaigning. It's not like she was doing a ton of it anyway. There's just not much you can do. People have tried to, for example, John Hickenlooper, the likely challenger to the Republican incumbent in Colorado, held a Facebook Live event with the former Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius last week, talking about coronavirus issues. It's a far cry from your typical campaigning. Obviously, nobody's out, nobody's on the stump, and really, Senate races. I heard earlier somebody was talking about how the a lot of people aren't really thinking about politics right now. They're thinking about the realities that are facing us all, and even the presidential campaigns become something of an afterthought. Well, that's exponentially so for Senate campaigns. I think most people are, you know, if they think about their senator, they're wondering what is happening in Washington. Is there going to be, you know, another stimulus? How does the stimulus help me and my family, as opposed to thinking about November?
Mm. Well, we also mentioned that in the close of the last segment, Anthony pointed out how governors are getting a lot of respect and approval because they are on the front lines in their states handling these issues. I believe that it's in Montana that Governor Bullock there is up for re-election.
Or so Bullock is the incoming governor, and he's running against the he's a Democrat. He's running against Steve Daines, the incumbent Republican senator.
Got it.
He announced just before the coronavirus outbreak. He for basically a year plus had been saying no, he wasn't going to run. And then he was the biggest recruiting coup, I would say, for the Democrats. And it looks incredibly fortuitous now because, yes, governors are suddenly being looked at as this very popular figure. Montana is a very hard state for Democrats, but Bullock's a Democrat who's shown he can win statewide. And now suddenly governors come with this extra burnished glow. So that makes the Montana Senate race very interesting. But much as is the case in the other states, obviously Bullock has been spending his time trying to deal with the virus right now. He's not exactly out on the stump, and neither Daines is not exactly touring around the state either. He is laying low and doing what I think most people are doing nowadays.
Right. So one more question for you, Nick. The actual act of voting. Now, there are some Western states that have really, for a long time, embraced vote by mail. As a native Oregonian, I'm just going to point that out. Oregon's been doing it for a while. But, you know, depending on where we are with the pandemic in November, what Western states are set up to have people not have to go to the polls to cast their ballots?
So this is a question that has a lot of implications for the Senate race, for all the Senate races as well, obviously, as the presidential. The West is pretty much where all-mail voting has really taken hold. Oregon was the first. Oregon, Washington, Utah, Hawaii, and Colorado, arguably California, and Arizona. California and Arizona are not complete all-mail states, but they are well set up to do that sort of thing. Are places where you could see the system switching to a largely male or an all male effort, and the states I just ticked off, like Colorado, for example, where I'm based, everybody gets a ballot through the mail anyway. In those places, they're probably, you could see how they could do an election in November without a huge amount of disruption. In that sense, there are so many wild cards right now in politics. Nobody really knows how this is going to all play out, and nobody exactly knows who's going to go to the polls or what the level of safety will be about going to the polls in November. So you can say with a certain level of confidence that in places like Arizona and Colorado, at least you could see an electorate that looks vaguely like the electorates that we've seen in previous elections. Not sure that will be the case in Montana, which is not set up for as easily for all-mail voting. And obviously the rest of the country, there are a lot of big question marks about that.
Well, Nicholas Riccardi, political reporter for the Associated Press, covering the western regions of the United States, with us from Denver. Nick, thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me.
Alexi and Anthony, let me turn back to you. And Alexi, I'll start with you. We've also heard, for example, at the national level, Senator Amy Klobuchar trying to push forward more vote by mail across the country. Is that gaining any traction?
Yeah, you know, that's exactly right. Senator Amy Klobuchar and Ron Wyden have co-sponsored legislation that, you know, is pushing states to allow mail-in voting for all voters without an excuse. As was just discussed, there are several states that, you know, don't allow people to vote by mail without an excuse. And those two senators are holding a conference call today. They're trying to get more support for that. And as you both know, in the stimulus bill that was just passed in Congress, there was only $400 million available for election assistance. And that might sound like a lot on the surface, but the Brennan Center for Justice has estimated that in order for states to make the changes that they need to implement a robust and expansive vote-by-mail program across the country in time for the general election, it would cost over $2 billion.
Mm.
So there's a lot of money that we need to find to be able to pull something like this off by November.
On the other hand, we have multi-trillion dollar assistance and stimulus coming out of Washington. So when the motivation is there, it's there. Anthony, yes. What do you think?
I think so. I mean, I think it makes a lot of sense. As we heard Nick talking, describing how in a lot of those Western states, voting by mail already exists. So I think this is legislation. I mean, my guess, I'm laughing just because every time I make a prediction, like, it blows up. But I'm guessing that this is the kind of legislation that would be well received in this moment. And coming from Ron Wyden and Amy Klobuchar, my understanding is the bill would also expand early in-person voting, which would lessen lines at polling stations on Election Day. That seems like a no-brainer. I mean, we have that in Massachusetts, for example. I mean, these are just a lot of sort of common sense tweaks, not just tweaks, but they include tweaks that seem to make a lot of sense and make voting easier and expand the franchise.
Could I add something quickly? I mean, I think the one wild card, of course, to all of that you just said is that, yes, it's common sense measures, but we have to think about Republican governors and Republican secretaries of state who might, you know, follow suit with others in the Republican Party who, you know, aren't necessarily inclined to make it easier for folks to vote.
It's
some
a great point, Alexi.
Voting
I'm
laws
glad you made
have come from Republicans. Yeah. And so I think that's kind of an interesting wild card. And when I talk to Democratic secretaries of state, Democratic governors, they sort of say the same thing, or even, you know, chairs of Democratic parties around the country. They talk about these fights that they're having with their Republican colleagues about, you know, not just the efficacy of something like voting by mail, but the safety of voting by mail, the logistics of voting by mail. And Democrats maintain that, you know, let's think of a state like Texas, which has 16 million voters. Democrats maintain that if 16 million voters were sent a mail-in ballot, that Democrats would win elections in Texas up and down the ballot because they think increased turnout helps them. Studies show increased turnout can benefit both Republicans and Democrats, but we've seen how Republicans more than Democrats often implement these stricter voting laws, and I think that's an interesting twist when we're thinking about what might gain traction to make it easier to vote by mail.
Yeah. Well, I want to go back to our callers here because as we, you know, march through the spring and into the summer, there's the question of the nominating conventions. So Chris is calling from Adams, Wisconsin. Chris, you're on the air.
Thank you. We're dead in the middle of this thing right now. Our primary is on Tuesday. The governor has refused to move it, even though there are lawsuits by people like the League of Women Voters going through the courts right now, but it's too close. So he's called out the National Guard to take over the polls because the elderly people are in such danger for being there. I wanted to talk about the convention a little bit. Joe Biden asked that it be postponed. But the virus is not supposed to peak in Wisconsin until the end of May. And depending upon how well we deal with it, what does that mean? It's supposed to be held on July 13th and 14th, I think. And that's too close. And nobody really knows. And so my question about that, I have one more point to make after this. The question about that is it legal for them to have a convention by, you know, teleprompters and stuff? And what is going to happen with that whole thing? And there's an alderman in Milwaukee who has just said it's not going to happen. We're just going to vote it out completely. Can I just make one more point?
Yeah, quickly, Chris, because I do want to hear what Anthony and Alexi have to say about the conventions.
There is a mayoral race on the ballot in November that is getting very interesting. In Milwaukee, the outbreak is exclusively in one neighborhood in the black community. There is a black female state senator who is running against the longtime mayor, Tom Barrett, and she lives in that community. He lives in a gated white enclave in the city. And this is going to get very interesting, this whole thing. She has accused him of being not receptive to little people. And the Democratic Party has basically run the inner city and they're walking into the ground.
Well, Chris, and I'm going to take it back from you here. What you're bringing to us is actually information I don't really know all that much about. So I want to look into it before we talk more about it. But Chris, thank you so much for your call. Anthony, about those conventions, what's going to happen?
We don't know for sure, but as the caller suggested, she's correct. Joe Biden I think it was just last night, he's been hinting that he thinks that the Democratic convention should be moved. It's presently scheduled for July in Milwaukee, and he wants to move it into August. It's a huge logistical undertaking. I mean, because, you know, networks and all kinds of people have already made tons of hotel reservations. But that's what the Democrats want to do. And it makes sense if you think about it, because if the convention were to be canceled or if it went to sort of all, online, for example, which would be perfectly legal, the Democrat, Biden, the candidate, wouldn't get that huge sort of bounce that you get from a big kind of party celebration. So there's a feeling that it needs to be moved to August, but there are big logistical challenges to consider how to make that work.
Alexei, I mean, I'll be frank. This is a moment where I'm wondering if we should be asking in terms of, the bounce is one thing, but beyond that, what is the purpose of a convention? Do we really even need to have one?
No, I'm a firm believer that we do not need to have a convention, but also I fully recognize that I'm young and have come up in a different era and generation and don't have the same sort of nostalgic tie to something like the Democratic Convention. I mean, it's all, pompous and pageantry. It's a show. It's a performance. It's a celebration for the Democratic Party. That's not to say that Democrats shouldn't have a celebration, just like Republicans have a celebration with the RNC. But, that's really what it is. And if you have to move to a virtual convention, what are you going to do? Have a laugh track in the background? Have a button that you press over the cheering and balloons are falling from the sky in one Zoom box? I mean, I just feel like the point of a celebration is not going to translate to a virtual convention.
Or what are those Zoom backgrounds, right? Like,
Suddenly everyone's like in space or on the, yeah, I know. But I just think the point of it is a celebration. And I think if that is the point, then and obviously there are logistics that happen at the convention. I'm not ignoring those things, but you can do those things over the phone. You could do a conference call of sorts to decide to do the roll call vote or something like that. But
right.
I just think that the physical convention, especially at a time like this, there's no need to put people in danger.
Right. So, I mean, first, sort of practically speaking, I mean, there are platforms that are put together in the conventions as well. Back in the day where we had contested conventions, or even this time around where there was a thought of one, maybe a lifetime ago, maybe, you could see a purpose for it. But look, all bets are off right now. Anthony, we've got about a minute and a half left, and there's one question I want to ask you here. I wonder if maybe the changes we're seeing in campaigning because of coronavirus might actually be a good thing. And here's why. Because of, we're used to the pomp and the circumstance and the strategizing that Alexei was talking about. When all of that is swept away, because we're living in this completely different world right now, the infotainment aspect of campaigning is being bled out. And instead, we have voters' minds being focused maybe on what actually they really want in leadership. You have to listen to what the president's saying. You got to listen to the ideas that Joe Biden or Senator Sanders are putting out there now. Could it actually be a good thing in terms of our politics?
I mean, the way you described it, I wouldn't take issue with it. I agree with you. I like the idea of it really sort of focusing the minds of voters on what it is they want. I also like the reality, to a certain extent, of it's forcing candidates to give up the BS, frankly, and really meet voters where they are and to talk about the issues that they're dealing with today. So in that sense, I guess as someone who's followed politics for a long time, I'm skeptical that we will learn these lessons for the long term, whatever those lessons are. But I think you raise a great set of questions, Meghna. I really do. And I think they're worth considering.
Maybe I'm just stubborn in my hopefulness about lessons we all might learn here. But Anthony Brooks, On Point's 2020 political correspondent and senior political reporter for WBUR. Anthony, it's always great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you, Meghna. It's been great.
And Alexi McCammon, political reporter for Axios, focusing on the 2020 presidential election. Alexi, it was great to have you as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Meghna. Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.